I want to begin by just reading a passage from the book of Proverbs, which sets a context for this first session where we're talking about teaching. The writer says, "My son, do not forget my teaching, but keep my commands in your heart, for they will prolong your life many years and bring you prosperity. Let love and faithfulness never leave you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Then you will win favor and a good name in the sight of God and man. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not unto your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and shun evil, and this will bring health to your body and nourishment to your bones." It's interesting the way in which the writer to the Proverbs sets that whole context, where he gives us imperatives, commands, but then says practically, this is to your benefit. I've been teaching ethics for many years. People in Britain think that ethics is the county next to Fathick. When you're teaching people about ethical issues, the importance of the imperative is very important. And I used to say, you know, we believe in principles. That's what evangelicals, that's what Christians do. We're not interested in consequences. And then I read the Bible more carefully. And when you read the Bible very carefully, you discover that God and Christ are deeply concerned about consequences. And the writer to the Proverbs is saying there are consequences about the way that you live and the way that you teach and the effect of your teaching. And so there are good consequences if there is good teaching, good education, and young people actually grow and develop. I, of course, began lecturing in the Holy Land, which you all know is Scotland. And Scottish people, of course, are very, very polite. And I would go in the morning, I'd say to the students, "Good morning." And they would say, "Good morning, sir." They spell it C-U-R, but that's the way they spell it in Scotland. And then I moved to England. I became a missionary in the deep south, in England. And there I was in the Midlands, which was a very depressing kind of experience. And I'd go into the students and I would say to them, "Good morning." And they would all ignore me. Mm-hmm. But then I moved to Oxford, the city of the dreaming spires. And they tell me that we have got some of the finest intellects in the world. And you go into lecture theatre and you say to the students, "Good morning," and they all write it down. Part of the trouble with teaching is that it's not just about you, it's also about the people that you're teaching. And my aim for today is not for me to come down from the mountain with a couple of tablets and say, "Swallow them," but rather for us together to engage and to learn from each other, to build on your kind of experience as well as my kind of experience. I want to tell you a little bit about my background. Terry has been very generous. I won't comment on his work because I'm gracious and loving, but I've had the benefit of different kinds of teaching experiences. I was taught in what I say in Oxford is a real university, Edinburgh, and there they blended different kinds of teaching. So yes, there were lectures, but the really important work was done mostly in the seminar context, where small groups worked together on a particular theme. And the aim of the tutor, the lecturer, was to try and guide the seminar through. But I was fortunate because I chose a topic that nobody else wanted to study. And I was given individual tuition, which was very, very rare in Scottish universities and in most English universities. And so I had the benefit of the tutorial kind of experience and working with one particular individual. I remember he was a well-known philosopher of religion. And the day came where we'd been working together for about 10 months. And he said, I think David. And that was the first time he'd ever called me by my name. He'd always talked about Mr. Cook. But then I knew this was a significant breakthrough because here was this individual actually calling me by my own name. It was very touching. But I was taught in Arizona State University. Now that was a culture shock from a little boy from the borders in Scotland, suddenly being transported to Arizona. Our average temperature in Hoyk is 52. So moving to Arizona, where for the first 4 months it was never below 100, was a bit shocking. I'd never flown before, so I got off the plane in Arizona, in Phoenix. And I thought, wow, these jet engines are really hot. It's amazing. And the further I got away from the plane, I thought, wow, that force of that heat. And of course, this was 10:30 at night, and it never occurred to me that this was what it was like all the time. So it was a different kind of experience. I benefited a great deal from Arizona State, but just let me say something about how not to do it. I went to class in philosophical idealism. It looked like a wonderful class, and I had some interest in this area of philosophical idealism. So the professor said at the beginning, "Now, any questions, just interrupt, just ask a question." Fine. So we've been talking for about 5-10 minutes, and I said, "Excuse me, could you just tell me what kind of idealism we're talking about? Are we talking about Platonic idealism? Are we talking about Kantian idealism? Are we talking about Bradleyan idealism? See me at the end of the hour." So the end of the hour, I went up to this guy and he said, "I give you an A, don't come back." So I don't think that is a great way to think, actually. But it was my introduction to American education. I thought, wow, is it going to be like this all the time? It wasn't, but that was one of my experiences. I was part of the bulge. 47 was a bulge year in Europe, and lots of people went to university, and lots of people graduated, lots of people did PhDs, and then they were all looking for jobs. So there were huge numbers, 200 people plus applying for every academic post. I'm sure some of you are almost as old as I am, so you know the kind of pressure that created. And it was difficult to find a job, but I did find a job. I'm a Baptist, but I went to teach in an Episcopalian seminary. So that was a shocking experience for them. One of the advantages was this seminary was actually linked into the university in Nottingham. And so I was able to teach both seminary students, but also ordinary undergraduates, and of course, eventually graduates. But while I was there, we were paid a pittance. You might think American beginning salaries are bad. You haven't seen British beginning salaries. That's the case. And so I looked for extra work. And what could I do? Well, I could talk and I could teach. And so I went to the Polytechnic. Now, Polytechnics, study of skills, no longer exist. They've become now universities, what are called new universities, or in Cambridge they call them puniversities, because they're not fully developed. And I taught social and political philosophy to builders. These were people who were doing a degree in building and construction. And they were required to do this course on a Friday morning at 9 o'clock, 150 of them. Now, I have to tell you, if you can teach ethics, social and political philosophy to 150 builders at 9 o'clock on a Friday morning, you can teach anything, really. And so that was a great experience, because it was very different from the seminary, where people really wanted to study, or in the university, where you had some very bright people who wanted to study and some who wanted to party. Well, we saw that last night downtown here in Madison. But also to make money and survive. We'd been married for 3 or 4 years, but the children were on the way now. And so I taught in a high school. It was a girls' high school, because private education, you do not have to have teaching qualifications. And I'm not qualified to teach, so I was able to get a job in a girls' high school teaching them. And so that was very interesting, working with 17 and 18-year-olds, trying to teach them. In the UK, you can do, we call them A-levels, the national exams in the area of religious studies. And so I was teaching them philosophy and ethics and some New Testament. So I have a range of experience which has made a difference. And then, after 6 years of teaching, partly in the seminary, partly in the university, and then the medical school asked me to begin teaching medical ethics. Medical ethics, before I started, was, "May I examine you?" That was medical ethics. It was professional etiquette. But now, of course, technology was beginning to develop. And here in America, you already had bioethics, medical ethics. But in Britain, there wasn't any. And so the Nottingham School of Medicine wanted to develop that, and so I began teaching there. And then Oxford had what I'd been doing, and they invited me to go in 79 to Oxford. Now, I had never been to Oxford or Cambridge, so it was a different kind of world. And I was told that I had to teach everybody individually. The tutorial system is a very, very different way of learning. Terry's referred to, you know, at the MPhil level. Well, at the undergraduate level, in the sciences, as well as in arts and humanities, every area you teach by tutorial. And so the student, it's a wonderful way of teaching, because the student does all the work and you can take all the credit. So you give the student reading, he or she goes away, they work for a week reading all the material, and at the end of the week they come back and they read their essay aloud. And you, in a gentle, loving way, tear it apart line by line. And we call this teaching. It's the art of trying to develop a person's thinking, a person's writing, and a person's expression. If you go to media outlets, if you go to business, if you go to government in the UK, you will find that many, many people at the top echelons went through Oxford and Cambridge. And people say, why? Is this the class system? No, it's the education system. It's because these people have learned how to work on their own. It's a wonderful way of teaching people research skills, because they are able to investigate anything. I think of a student of mine who studied philosophy and went to work in the Department of Transport for the government. And the government minister said to him, first day he was on the job, we want a plan for transport in London. You have 2 weeks. Now, this boy knew nothing about transport. He'd only been to London 3 or 4 times. He knew nothing about it, but he knew how to do research. And so he was able to produce in 2 weeks, not the plan which solved all the problems, but a way forward. And so that's the kind of skill that the tutorial system teaches. It's wonderful for really bright students. It's daily crucifixion for the poor student, because you have to sit and read aloud with embarrassment. I say to my people, I don't mind you weeping during the tutorial. I don't mind you weeping at the end of the tutorial. But I do find it difficult if you weep before we start. I have had students standing outside waiting to come in weeping because they knew how poor their paper was. And they knew that we would have to go through it in a consistent, hopefully constructive way, but they were embarrassed. Now, I was embarrassed. I was a member of one young lady who said to me, I can't read you my paper, it's too awful. And I said, well, you know, the tutorial thing is about reading the paper, so give it to me and I will read it. I will read it aloud. She said, you will degrade me if you read my paper aloud to me. So what can you do in that kind of setting? Because the whole business is about the individual expressing ideas, then defending their particular analysis, their particular critique, and then trying to build on that in a constructive kind of way. And now, of course, I've been teaching for the last 7 years, part of the year, in Wheaton, which is a different kind of experience, and I've been teaching for about 10 years down in Southern Seminary. So I have some experience in the range of education in the Western world. I do have to say that if you've taught in the East, Far East, it's a very different kind of experience. I remember in Korea going to teach there, and they said to me, students will never ask you a question. And I was used to people engaging and asking questions. And so I would, you know, stop in the middle of a lecture and say, anybody not understand anything? Total silence. Any questions you have? Total silence. And at the end I would say, well, here are some questions. So I would ask the question. Nobody would say anything. Because giving honour to the lecturer, to the teacher, is very important. Part of the problem was if you met the student in the corridor, he or she would bow to you. And I was taught that what you have to do is bow back. So I would bow back. And then they would bow a little bit lower. And I would bow a little bit lower. And eventually they're almost on their knees. And it was a kind of, it was so formalized. And it was very difficult, you know, after being used to a very informal back and forth, to be in a very formalized, proper kind of setting. So the setting makes a tremendous difference. That's why I want to begin by talking about teaching in context. We have to teach in a way which actually fits in to the particular kind of institution. Now, if I'm in the medical school, that would be different from presenting something in the philosophy department, which would be different from teaching in the theology faculty. You have to be appropriate, and appropriate particularly to the historical way they've done it. You know, part of the difficulty is that sometimes we think my way of doing it is the best, it might well be. But we have to fit into that context, because it's very difficult for students who've learned a gear. There's a gear that happens in all academic institutions, which is why you really need to teach for the year. Because in teaching for a year, you get the whole of the experience. You get the balance between vacation time, seminar, semester time or term time. You get a different sense. We have in Oxford, week six. We only teach 8 weeks in Oxford. That's as long as we can stand the students. So 8 weeks. And week six is what we call six-week blues. The students become depressed. The faculty become depressed. My medical friends tell me suddenly the doctor's surgeries are full of people at the point of breakdown. They're no longer able to cope. And so you have to make sure that week six, you're watching, first of all, for suicide. We have a very high suicide rate, sadly, in Oxford because of the pressure. But also for levels of depression. And we try always to do something, party, something exciting, some social event in week six to give people a boost. And then, of course, there's only 2 weeks left before the end of the term, end of the semester. So there's a rhythm. And once you've been there 2 or 3 years, you see this rhythm. And other people, you know, doctors who are not part of the university, they can see this rhythm. It's quite clear. So there's a tradition. And, of course, there's a particular style that people have of teaching. I am technologically challenged, and so it's almost impossible for me to use overheads. Terry mentioned I've been on the Xenotransplantation Interim Regulatory Authority in the UK. Now, if you can say that in Oxford, we give people a degree. The Xenotransplantation Interim Regulatory Authority. And I went to the World Congress on Xenotransplantation. Both of us. No, there was a lot of people all over the world. They've been looking at xenotransplant, taking organs from animals and putting them in human beings, taking tissue from animals and putting them in human beings. And it raises all kinds of moral questions, which is why they asked me to help and advise. I went to World Congress and I signed up for one session. And the first speaker got up and he said, "I've got an overhead presentation." And he put in his computer and nothing happened. So half an hour later, still nothing had happened. So they said, "We'll go to the second speaker." And he got up and said, "I have a presentation, computerized." He switched it on, nothing happened. So people began to get a little fidgety. When number five still couldn't get his computer system to work, and none of them had a hard copy with them. They all just had a disk. And so the five sessions we missed. And so I was like a breath of fresh air when I got up number six, because I just had a piece of paper and some notes and just talked. So at least we redeemed it in a little bit, but not totally. There's a tradition, there's a way, and we have to fit in with that gear. And it's very important when we start in an institution that we pick up that atmosphere. When I began teaching in Oxford, nobody ever said, "This is how you do a tutorial." I'd never been in a tutorial. I'd never experienced, apart from in Edinburgh, but I didn't know whether Oxford tutorials were the same as Edinburgh tutorials. And so nobody ever said, "I'll come to your lecture and see whether you can lecture, or I'll come to a seminar and help you how to run a seminar, or I'll come to a tutorial and help you run a tutorial." Nobody taught me. Whereas now, if you're a new member of faculty, you have to go a six-week training. That they actually take, they televise, they record your lecturing, they have you lead a seminar, and there's constant feedback, because they know that it's not automatic. People can be brilliant exam candidates, they can be brilliant researchers, but they cannot teach for toffee. And we need to help people and pick up how does this institution actually function. We need to teach people how to teach. But we need to teach them in a style which is real to them. In seminary, what we do is we have a thing called sermon class. You go and you hear people preach a sermon. And of course, you want it to be as real as possible. So you go to the local church where this individual is, and he, usually he, but sometimes she, will preach. And then after the service is over, you sit down, you get some of the congregation to come, and you take the sermon apart. What worked, what didn't work. You actually give them immediate kind of feedback. Now, part of the difficulty is students think there is a magical way to teach. Here's Martin Lloyd-Jones. This is the way to preach. Here's John Stott. This is the way to preach. In Scotland, we had a very well-known Presbyterian man called Jim Phillip, who was a wonderful preacher. But I had many friends who were studying for ministry in the Presbyterian church. Whenever I went to hear them preach, if you closed your eyes, you thought you were listening to Jim Phillip, because they all preached in exactly the same way, except for Jim Phillip, it was real. It was genuine. This was what the man was like. But when they preached, they were copying, and they were poor imitations. And so we had to say to people, you've got to teach or preach in your own style, in a way which is real, because you've got to sustain it for 30, 40 years in your life. If you're going to sustain it day after day, week after week, you've got to have a level of comfort which is natural to the way in which you teach. I think that most of us teach in reactive ways. We react to things that we saw really worked and worked well. We react against things that did not work well. I think about PhD supervision. And, you know, when I take a student, particularly if it's an older person, somebody who's already in professional life and has given up quite a great deal to come and do a PhD in Oxford, and so I try to teach them as a colleague. But I say to them, as we're going to work through the PhD, every now and then I'm going to stop and say, notice what we're doing here. This is the way that we're trying to develop your teaching. And so when you become a PhD supervisor, this is how you will do it. But most of us react either the way that we were taught, well, that was wonderful, so that's the way you do it, or the way I was taught was terrible, and I will never teach in that kind of way. We are reactive. And sometimes reactions are good things, but sometimes they really narrow down the way in which we teach and help us not to develop our own style of teaching. Now, there is a difference in the students. And crudely and simply, I think there's a difference between arts and humanities and the sciences. C.P. Snow used to talk about the two cultures. And there are two very different kinds of cultures. And you have to be appropriate to the culture. And, you know, with my accent, I can get away with the novelty factor. When I was a student in Arizona, people used to take me out for dinner and said, you know, just read the telephone book to us and that will pay for the dinner, because they like the accent. But novelty will only take you so far. You need something more. And you have to be clear. How do these students think? How do they actually learn? How do they actually gain information? How do they process it? And how can I present material in a way which is appropriate to them? So it depends on the subject, and of course it depends on the student. If I'm honest with you, my preference is to teach older people. Teaching undergraduates is a nightmare, because 18, 19-year-olds, they open their mouths and they swallow whole everything you say. They just are blotters. They soak in like a sponge. They soak in everything, but they don't process it. And then they regurgitate it. And they think, this is what you want to hear. I don't want to hear me again. I know what I think. Don't tell me what I think. I want to know what you think. But the students, now older people who have an experience of life, experience of the working world, they are less like parrots. They are people who actually bring their own work and their own life experience into the lecture theatre, the seminar, the tutorial. And so age makes a difference, and experience makes a difference. But now, of course, there are all kinds of different levels of teaching as well. The difference between teaching an 18, 19-year-old and teaching a graduate student who's in his or her final year. You know, that we have to adapt. It's not one size fits all. It's actually being appropriate to these different kinds of students at the different level, different age, a different experience. But I think we do have to also bear in mind that now much of our teaching, whether we like it or not, is not about education for education's sake. In Oxford, we don't say, what's your major? We don't even say, what are you studying? We say, what are you reading? Because the idea of the Oxford degree was you simply read for 3 years. There's no continuous assessment, there's no grade average, no exams till the very end. And at the end of the 3 years, then they sit exams. But for the rest of the time, all they do is read. They don't have to go to any lectures. They have to come to the tutorial, but they never, they're students who have never attended a lecture, never actually been in a lecture theatre, because they want simply to read. Now that's a very different kind of learning. Just reading, but now most students want to know what they're going to do. It's not just the students who want to know what they're going to do, it's the parents who want to know. What's the point in studying philosophy? All the time, parents are saying that, phoning up saying, my son, my daughter wants to study philosophy. What on earth will they do with a philosophy degree? So the job market, and we have to be aware that people are going to need to develop skills. Now I say when people ask about philosophy, what we're doing is we're teaching them to think critically. To think critically and to think creatively. That's what we're doing, I think, in terms of teaching people for life. We teach them, first of all, to think, because actually, thinking is not something that people do very naturally. What they do is they feel, they react, they engage, they relate, but stopping and reflecting, stopping and thinking, it's actually more difficult to do than many people think. So teaching people to think, but also to think critically. I have a friend, and if you knew me better, you'd know how remarkable that is. But anyway, my friend is a Scotsman, because as members of a persecuted minority group, we stick together. And one day my friend said to me, David, because that's the kind of friends that we are. You know, we call each other by our first name. David, he said, I'd like to cut off one of your hands. These are the kinds of friends that I have. You know? But when you've studied philosophy, you get used to what people say. And I said, well, that's very interesting, Arthur. Why would you like to cut off one of my hands? He says, well, David, it would stop this annoying habit you have of saying, on the one hand, and then on the other hand. Now, that's what teaching critically means. You're able to see things from more than your own perspective. There is in sociology and in logic a thing called the dictatorial strategy, which is when I present an idea, you have to think like me, otherwise there's no room for the critic. And that's flawed. It's interesting in the New Testament that Jesus always allows room for people to say no, for people to disagree, for people to have a different perspective. He doesn't want them to have a different view, he doesn't want them to have a different perspective, but he recognizes that not everybody is going to be convinced. And there has to be genuine room, a place for the critic to stand. And that's teaching people to think critically, to recognize, if I think this is a good idea, why is this a good idea? If I think this is a bad idea, why is it a bad idea? Now here are two sets of arguments. How can I evaluate? The word critical, we think it's negative, not at all. If I say, that's a really nice jumper you've on today, that's a critical judgment. Because the word in the Greek simply means to make a judgment. And you have positive and negative judgments. And we need to be able to assess and help people assess. How do they process the information? Think of the media. My father-in-law is 103. And he is totally mentally with it and a news-aholic. A news-aholic. He listens to the 7 o'clock news in the morning. And then he listens to the 8 o'clock news. And then he listens to the 12 o'clock news, the 1 o'clock news, and then he listens to the 5 o'clock news, the 6 o'clock news, and then he listens to the 9 o'clock news and the 10 o'clock news to make sure they haven't changed the news. That's his real concern. Now, what's interesting, if you're with him, you listen to the news and you watch the news all these different times. And what's amazing is the way in which different news, different channels, different programs offer you different perspectives on exactly the same thing. It's really quite frightening that we can have one. This is the best thing since sliced bread. This is a total disaster. They're talking about the same thing. But is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? How are we to assess the information which is being given to us? Because, of course, the newscasters, not the newscaster literally himself or herself, but the people who run it, the editors, are selecting. The government in Britain had been taking evidence about euthanasia, whether or not we would introduce euthanasia. And they produced a report. And the BBC phoned me up at 4 o'clock and said, would you like to comment on the government report? I said, well, I'm happy to comment, but I haven't read it. I haven't read it because it hasn't been published yet. It's not going to be published till 4:30. So how can I comment on something I haven't seen? They said, 4:30 we'll send it to you. Fax it. Now, the problem was I was teaching at 4 o'clock and 5 o'clock, and this was for the 6 o'clock news. So I have a researcher, and he read this 46 pages of facts from the BBC. And he told me the key points. So they phoned me up about 5:30, 5:45, and said, what do you want to say about this? And I said, well, this is a very interesting report, because the government are holding the line. The government are saying no change. This is upholding traditional values. They said, that's very interesting. And then they didn't phone at 6 o'clock. So I knew I was not on the news. I hadn't on the news to see what happened. Here's the report about the new government report, and here's a colleague of mine from Manchester University. And they say to him, what do you think of this issue? This is absolutely incredible. This is a change in the traditional view. This is overthrowing everything. Now, if I'd been the editor, and I had somebody who said, this is status quo, or this is something fundamentally different, I'd have gone with the other guy too. But they're selecting the spin on the story. They're selecting the emphasis of the story. They're selecting who gets to present and what they are going to say. What kind of view is actually going. And the public think this is true. This is objective reality. This is objective fact. No, this is somebody's opinion. But it's very difficult to engage critically. And we need to help people to think critically. But I think the mistake in academia is we stop there. Actually, that's not the end. The real end is to help people think creatively. Now, that's much, much more difficult. How you help people construct. I get people from all over the world coming and saying, I want to do a PhD with you. And I say, well, what do you want to study? You tell me. I say, no, the whole point in doing a PhD is it's your PhD. I've already got 3 doctorates. I don't need any other ones. Thank you very much. So you have to tell me, because you're the one who'll do the work. And it's actually very difficult to come up with a brand new, a new spin, a new set of experiments, a new perspective. And of course, in the arts and humanities, the easiest way is compare and contrast. You know, you take 2 separate things and put them together. And comparing and contrasting, you can actually come up with something that nobody's ever done before. That's the easiest kind of thesis. But actually doing it and sustaining it, thinking creatively. And I think the challenge for us, particularly for Christians, is how can we help our students think in a constructive, creative way, rather than simply rehashing the old debates. I've been teaching history of philosophy paper in Oxford for 30 plus years. And I worked out the other day, I've listened to 563 essay papers, tutorial papers, on Descartes' method of doubt. And I can tell you honestly, I have never learned anything new from these 563 papers. But I believe that I could learn something new. So every time a student comes in with his or her essay on Descartes' method of doubt, I live in hope that there will be something new, something different. Now, of course, I have to remember that for this student, this is the first time he or she has read Descartes, first time they've engaged with the method of doubt. So to them, it's brand new. But I'm looking for them to come up with a new kind of perspective, to be creative. And if I can find a student who has that creative spark, I want to grow it, I want to make it into a blazing flame, because they are going to make a difference in not just in academia, but in the world as a whole. Finding people who can think, not just think critically, but think creatively. I have a colleague who's an assistant dean at Wheaton, and he says that in his time, 25, 30 years, he's seen a shift. And I like his line, from the sage on the stage to the guide on the side. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that's very interesting, because here are we with the sage on the stage. Here am I standing up, I give you a handout, and we work through the sage on the stage. And what we will do, and that's why the discussion, is not an add-on, it's not a fill-in, it's something which is actually vital. It's the guides together, side by side, learning from each other. What works, what doesn't work? What are the issues that we face in our teaching? What can we do better? How can we help each other? That's the way we learn. And to be honest, that's the way students learn. You know, the definition of a lecture is how you get the words on the lecturer's piece of paper onto the student's piece of paper without it passing through either of their minds. and that's really quite frightening. There's no real engagement. That's the trouble with handouts, that's the trouble with overhead projectors and all that. You want the people to engage, to think. And being the guide on the side makes a difference there. But we have new technologies. New technologies which make the visual much more important. This is not a great way of teaching. We live in an age where people like to see things. They like to see pretty pictures. They like to have lots of movement. They like music. They like background. Notice in church services, how often now in prayer time, there's music in the back. How often, I've been in a number of churches where suddenly the preacher breaks into song. It's a different kind of rhythm, a different kind of style. People love it. You think this is much more whole than somebody standing up and speaking for 35, 40 minutes, however long. I used to do a daily program called Thought for the Day. It happens in the main news on the BBC, and this is what all the intelligentsia, that would be the best way of expressing it. Everybody in politics, business, the media, they all listen to the main Radio 4 Today program, it's called. And in that slot, between 7:30 and 8, there are 3 minutes that you are given to give a thought for the day. For the whole nation, they have 3 minutes, and you can say anything about a news item, and you put it in a moral perspective. And I did that for many, many years. And a commercial radio decided they would copy it. So I got a call from a commercial company. We would like you to do Thought for the Day for us. Would you do 5? We'll pre-record them and we can put them out, feed them into our programs. I said, that's fine. So I went along with my 5 scripts and they said, sit down, read it. And so I read it aloud. And they said, these are great, but they're too long. I said, what do you mean they're too long? 2 minutes, 30 seconds. I said, what? We have 3 minutes on the BBC. Oh, no. If the young people do not hear music every 2 minutes 30 seconds, they'll switch off or change channels. 2 minutes 30 seconds. Now, I'm always invited places twice. The second time to apologize. So I was invited again. Come and do another 5. So I wrote my 5, 2 minutes 30 seconds, and I went along, and you know, I can run exactly to time. And so I did my 5, 2 minutes, and they said, that was great, except they're too long. I said, now hold on. 3 minutes was too long, so we went to 2 minutes 30 seconds. Now you're telling me 2 minutes 30 seconds too long. How long is it supposed to be? 90 seconds. And I said, why 90 seconds? They said, the attention span of young people listening to words on their own is 90 seconds. Now, how many of you lecture in 90-second bursts? And so, you see, we have a cultural shift. A shift to the visual, a shift where the attention span. Now, I believe that young people can listen much, much longer than that. But actually, the culture is not encouraging that. And we have a program, pop music program, called Top of the Pops. And that's the best funded program in the BBC. That's where all the modern technologies, all the latest gadgets, all the latest recording techniques, all the latest visual pictures are done. I watch it. I watch it not because I'm interested in the music. I think it's music. I watch it because this is tomorrow's television. And the number of different pictures, the number of different sounds, the number of different angles, the changing, and its constant flow, and young people's ability to focus their attention on one thing in a sustained way is actually very difficult. So we need to help people by dealing with new technologies in an appropriate way. Inductive learning, distance learning. You'll know that now in medical school, you can sit in your room and you can watch a professor in Australia do a heart transplant. You can watch a professor in Singapore separate Siamese twins. And you can watch it live. And so why do I want to go down to the medical school and listen to some boring person talk about the theory when I can get online and see it all happening? Susan Boyle? I'm surprised you don't know Susan Boyle. The Scottish claim to fame is this lady from a little village, Bannockburn, in the middle of nowhere, and she's a singing sensation. It's over 50 million hits on YouTube. I mean, isn't that amazing? Because here's an ordinary, very plain, very down-to-earth, I think American phrase would be homely lady. And yet when she opens her voice, it's like an angel. And to see the faces of the judges, hard-bitten, professional people, and they were wowed. So the ability for people to see that, to see it happening, to see it as it's going on, is quite frightening, because there's an immediacy which teaching, and certainly teaching philosophy or teaching historically, is very different. And so we're competing. It's a very competing world. And we have to move with the technologies. I have TAs who, I don't let them mark my papers, but I do let them do overhead things for me, you know, make up a computer presentation, because they know how to do it. They can understand. I can't do it. I say, which button do I press? Just show me which button I press, and if it doesn't work, what do I do? That's what they need to tell me. But they do all the magic, and you just press the button. In the beginning was the Word. In the beginning, God. You see, whether it's the beginning of the Old Testament or whether it's the beginning of John's Gospel, it's always the priority of God and the God who speaks. It's no accident, it's Word. It's Logos. It's a way that people communicate, it's a way that God reveals himself. So teaching is based on a kind of revelation. God created the world, and so the psalmist says, if I look at the world, it teaches me. If I look at the heavens, it teaches me. If I look at human nature, it teaches me. Because God made the world. And so the world itself gives us teaching. We can learn. When I'm trying to show that I'm quite intelligent, I talk about the inherent intelligibility in the nature of things and the inherent intelligence in the nature of people. Actually, what we need to understand is that the world makes sense because God made the world, so it made sense. That's what makes science possible, because the world makes sense. It fits together. And because we have been given intelligence, we can think God's thoughts after him, we can make sense of the world, which makes sense. Now, we need both things. If the world was nonsense, we could try to make sense of it and we would fail. That's been the problem with cancer. We've been trying to make sense of it. How does cancer affect people? It's not just genetic, it's not just environmental. So what's the mix that actually produces cancer? And what are we going to do about it if we can understand the cause? How are we then going to deal with the effects of that? But God created and he reveals himself. That's why I believe there are so many physicists who are writing in the realm of religion and science today. Because the more they study, the more they see an order. The more they understand that this didn't just happen. When I was a student, the bête noire of religion, the guy that we love to hate, was Anthony Flew. Anthony Flew wanted to destroy religion. He wanted to destroy all belief in God. And I remember taking part in a program with him, and he and I disagreed quite violently on air. Flew now is a deist. He now believes that there is a God. He now believes that the world is so ordered, you can only make sense of it if there's a God. That people are so complex, you can only make sense of it if there's some kind of divine being. Now, that doesn't make him a spiritual Bible believer, but it does show a way in which the world itself and human nature itself can lead people to understand, because God reveals himself. Now, God teaches, and if we time and we don't, we go through the way in which in the Old Testament, he teaches through Word. God speaks. Now, it's a word which is a powerful word. Let there be light, and there was light. God speaks, and things happen. God creates, and things happen. But he teaches also by law. Now, law is very important. We don't like legalists. We always boo for the Pharisees. And I remember the chief rabbi in Britain saying to me, you know, rabbis got a bad rap. Rabbis were quite good guys because they really wanted to understand the law, and the law helped people. It helped them understand what is good and what's not good. How can I be good and how can I avoid being bad? And so the law was something, Paul says, to lead people to Christ, to show us how far short of God's standard before. So law has a teaching purpose. So do the prophets. The prophets used to say, hear the word of the Lord. But that doesn't translate properly. It's hear and obey the word of the Lord. Hearing was not enough. It meant that if you really heard, if you really listened, if you really understood, it would make a difference. You would change, you would act, you would react as a result of hearing this word. The prophets revealed God's word. And we read from Proverbs, Barkhouse, the wisdom books, where God gives very practical, very down-to-earth advice about how to live, which will make things good and make it good for people. People will flourish, people will grow, communities will grow, communities will flourish. So that's why I think this teleological, this consequence thing is actually very much a biblical perspective. Not on its own, not separated from the nature of God and the principles of God, but it's part of the whole concern that God has for the whole person. God reveals himself. And of course he reveals himself most of all, as John says, in the word, the Logos. Now the Logos, you know, there are books and books written about the meaning of the word Logos. But certainly in the Jewish and the Greek tradition, it meant the ordering principle. It meant the force which makes sense of things. It meant the word which people could hear and understand. It's no accident that Calvin believed that speaking and preaching was the fundamental way of teaching. Luther thought seeing was the fundamental way. One of the big disputes between Luther and Calvin was, is God revealing himself by seeing? You see the nature, you see the world, you see Jesus incarnate, seeing, or is it by speaking? Is it by preaching? Is it by God revealing his word, whether in law or whether in prophets or whether in the incarnate word? But Jesus teaches. So that there was a disagreement in the Reformation about which is primary. Now, I would think it's a both and rather than an either or. And so we have to have a proper understanding of what Logos means. But it's both spoken and it's incarnated. You can actually see it. Jesus says, if you have seen me, you have seen the Father. And so the seeing is very important. But also the teaching is very important. You know, Matthew 5-7 is the most consistent, sustained teaching that Jesus offers. And it's a parallel passage in what's called the Sermon on the Plain in Luke's Gospel, where Jesus pulls together the basic fundamental. What does it mean to be part of the community of God's people? What does it mean to be in the kingdom of God? What kind of life are we to live? What kind of teaching, what kind of values ought we to have? Now the Old Testament is all kind of models. Models about children, we read from Proverbs, and really it's about parents and children, the passage we read. And there are other parts of Proverbs and some of the Psalms which talk about how we should deal with our children. And it's no accident that at Passover, the youngest child present is to ask the question. The youngest child, because this is a teaching opportunity. We talk about teaching moments. You know, here are moments in life when we can actually communicate and teach something. Well, that's what the Passover was. It was a teaching moment. And the Jewish understanding was that we have to seize those teaching moments. As the child says, what does this mean? And now we have an opportunity to give the salvation history of the Jewish people. The Old Testament emphasizes that children need to be taught from the very beginning. They need a structure in which to learn. My wife was trained in what's called the Froebel method. And it was a child-centered education. And you know, occasionally I would go to visit her in the class of 4- and 5-year-olds. And it was organized chaos. Or disorganized chaos, because you'd have some children in the sand corner, you have some children in the play area, you'd have some children in the counting area, you'd some children reading, you'd some children murdering each other. All these things were happening in the classroom. And there was even a magic moment when she would say, stop! Everybody stop choosing. Now every child could choose to do whatever he or she wanted for the next 20 minutes. And that's child-centered education. Now, my wife assured me there was some structure in that, but I was not greatly convinced because the visual evidence did not seem to bear that out. But children need a structure by which to learn. They need to have some system by which they can actually understand things, which is why enactment is very important. I was talking with a friend who'd been to visit a family, and he was describing his relationship to the children. Now, he hadn't seen the children for a year, and only sees them really once every year or a couple of years. And I said, well, how did it go with the children? He said, oh, we great fun. We pretended to be James Bond. I was just a little concerned what I mean, James Bond he was doing with these three little girls, but he assured me it was very proper. But they enacted being a spy, they enacted chasing each other round the house. They enacted, because that's the way children learn. They see it enacted, the embodiment. That's why drama has become more and more part of church worship. Because that's why if you go to the Greek Orthodox Church, you will see there are huge paintings all round, because the sermons are so boring and the liturgy is so long, you need something to read to see which will actually teach you something. The enactment. And I go to preach in many Anglican churches what we call smells and bells. It's wonderful theatre. And if you understand the theatre, you understand what's going on. My wife was brought up in the Presbyterian Church. And in the Presbyterian Church in Scotland, service begins, the bell rings, time for the service. The first thing that happens is the beadle, the church worker, comes in carrying the Bible. And he or she takes the Bible up to the pulpit and opens the Bible. And then the minister comes in. Because the word has precedence. Now it's enacted. It's enacted every Sunday morning in most of the Presbyterian churches in Scotland, showing the people the precedent. The number one thing is the word. And anybody can read it. It's an open Bible. It's accessible to all. Doesn't depend just on the preacher. And that enactment is a very important way of learning. And repetition. Now you and I, I'm sure, were at the stage where you learned your tables. You repeated them. You learned it by rote. We learned it by rote because there's something. And if you've ever been at the Wailing Wall and watched people there praying, what do? They pray and they move. There's a repetition. There's a movement. There's a rhythm. And that rhythm helps them remember. And that's why we can rely so much on the Old and New Testament documents, because they came from a people who remembered things and remembered them exactly. It was important to get exactly the right word, to get exactly the right rhythm. And that repetition is fundamental. I want to suggest there is a Jesus model. Jesus model begins where people are. If you're a woman at a well, he talks to you about water. If you're a rich young ruler, he talks to you about riches. If you are a philosophical Pharisee and you want to know about the secret of being born again, he talks to you about being born again. Jesus adapted to where people were. He always began. He didn't leave them there, but that's where he began. He always used relevant pictures, illustrations. That's why the parables are so important, because they take real life experiences, things that really happen in the culture around, and make sense. I have a friend in Indonesia, and he's in charge of Sunday schools in youth in Indonesia. And one Sunday morning, he'd been in a class. And in the class, they were talking about, I am the good shepherd. And the teacher was saying to these children, here's Jesus, and Jesus is the good shepherd, and we are to be like sheep and follow Jesus. And Wayan said to the teacher, have you ever seen a sheep? No. Do you know what a shepherd is? Well, it's somebody who works with sheep. You've never seen a sheep. No. Have you ever met a shepherd? No. And he thought, so he's driving along from the church, and stops, because there was a flock of ducks walking across in front, and the ducks were all following the duckman. And now if you go to the Sunday school material in Indonesia, it says, I am the good duckman, the duck hear my voice, the duck follow. And they've taken a picture which means something to the people in Indonesia and captures the spirit, the live translation of what was Jesus actually communicating to the people of his day, and how can we find a picture which means the same. Now there are all kinds of dangers in that, but there's something really important about finding a relevant way. His attitude towards people is important. I think that students need to know, whether it's undergraduates, graduate students, or colleagues, they need to know that you care. They need to know that you care for them, that you are interested in them. That's why I give all the essays back individually. You have to come to me. Wheaton won't let me do tutorials. If you can teach 15 people, it takes 15 hours. That's the tutorial method. If you can teach 25 an hour and you have 15 hours of teaching, that's, you know, a huge amount. So cost effectiveness rules okay. But I believe it's very important that when people have taken the time and trouble to write an essay, I give them the time and trouble of sitting down and, you know, I've read the essay in advance and going through the essay with them and saying, this is good, this is not so good, this is what you need to do here, this is where the argument is weak, this is where your illustration, bless you, doesn't work, this is where the quotation doesn't work. That's the major problem I find with theses, is that people quote. And the quote doesn't make the point that they think it makes. It's not relevant to the point that they're trying to establish. They do nothing with the quotation. They quote it and they think, that's the end. No, it's the beginning. And so finding an attitude towards people which shows a genuine care. Jesus incarnated grace and truth. Now, it was not all truth. That would be too harsh. It was not all grace. That would be too soft. It's the perfect balance of grace and truth. And last evening we were talking with the graduate students, and the young lady asked the question about, should the church leave alone, not speak about hot button issues? People disagree, people react so strongly. So maybe we should say nothing about them. Maybe we should just love people. No, she wanted grace. But I think we need grace and truth. Because you need content. And people are not honored, people are not respected if you do not tell them and share the truth with them. But how we share the truth with them, how we express that grace in practice is important. And it's a personified. In John 13, we have that picture of Jesus washing the feet of the disciples. Here's enactment. Here is literally enactment, what service means. How should we act? How can we love one another? What does that mean in practice? It means being a servant. It means a foot washer. That's why on Maundy, Thursday, Maundy, the word Maundy comes from the Latin mandati. It's Jesus' command to love one another. That's what we celebrate. And that's why the Pope, 82 as he is, gets on his hands and knees and washes the feet of 12 people to show, to incarnate, to personify. That's what Jesus did, and that's what we ought to do. We ought to personify. We teach, crudely, we teach ourselves. We're actually sharing ourselves in teaching. And so what are we sharing? Who are we sharing? It needs to be holistic. By holistic, I mean about the whole person and the whole context, and particularly aware of what is this individual's needs. This young lady who used to weep before she came into my tutorials, she came from one college and there was a young man who came from the same college. And one day after 3 or 4 weeks, the young lady said to me, "You're not fair." And I said, "Why am I not fair?" She said, "You don't teach me the same way as you teach this other boy." And I said, that's absolutely correct. And I said, "I want you to stop and think. Do you really want me to teach you in exactly the same way as I teach him? Or would you rather I taught you in a way that was appropriate to you?" And she didn't take very long to say, "Well, maybe it's all right to be not fair." I said, "It is fair. It's fair because both of you are taught in the way that I believe, because of my experience, is the best way for you. And of course I'm making a judgment. My judgment could be wrong, but I'm saying, what's the best way of teaching this person? What's the best way of teaching that person? Be appropriate to the genuine needs of the person." But I think we need to challenge people in our teaching. The tutorial method, they have this week of learning, reading, writing, and then they come along and they read me the essay. And the essay, you know, describes, offers a critique, offers a conclusion, and then they stop. I say, "Hold on, you've missed something." And they say, "Well, what have I missed?" "So what? You've spent a week of your life, I spent an hour of my time listening to this, so what difference does it make? What on earth is the point in all this thinking? So what do we do with this now?" I think we need to challenge people to say, so what, is learning for its own sake, or is learning so that it makes some kind of difference? It may give us a focus, it may give us a new agenda, it may open new kind of doors, it may show insight into other kinds of areas, it may actually teach us what we need to know. So what? But we need room for questions. It's interesting how often in the stories of what Jesus did and how Jesus behaved, how people come to Jesus with questions. And the gospel writers record what the questions were and what the answers were. And Jesus is a master at dealing with people's questions. Sometimes he answers a question with a question. Sometimes he gets behind the question for what is really going on. But sometimes he literally answers the questions. And it's interesting, the different people who ask questions, whether it's the lawyers or whether it's the disciples. Here are the people who've been with Jesus for almost 3 years, and still they don't understand what's going on. And they say, when they've got him on his own, what really happened there, Jesus? What was really going on? So that question, room for questions, is important. I had a professor who taught theology, systematic theology, and he did not allow any questions except one day in the year. And you were supposed to write down your questions, and on that one day, the session was questions. And it was, you know, there were about 40, 50 students, and it was, you know, who's going to go first? It's always the problem, who's going to start? And this young man said, Professor, here's the question. So he asked him the question. And the professor took off his glasses. He said, young man, sin has blinded your mind. And until we deal with the sin, I'm not going to answer your question. Now, that was the last question that we had. Nobody else would ask a question. So here was a missed opportunity. Here was a genuine question the young man had, and it was just destroyed. And he was destroyed by the way it was dealt with. There has to be genuine questions and genuine responses. And the genuine response is, I don't know. I don't know, but I'll think about it. I don't know, but I'll come back to you on this. I don't think that we always have to be able to give an answer. Why the BBC like me is because I can always give you an answer. It doesn't matter what it is. I'm never stuck for something to say. But actually, sometimes we should say, I should say, I don't know. Because the effect of saying, I don't know, but I want to learn, I want to find out, I want to explore. So this is what we're going to do. This is how we're... You don't just say that and nothing more. You have to take it somewhere. But it's still responding to genuine questions. Jesus was God incarnate. Jesus was the King of Glory. Jesus had given up heaven to come to earth. And he meets people. You know, I often think, what would it have been like to have met Jesus? To actually have sat down and talked with them and just be in his presence. And you'd have thought, if I was with Jesus, it would affect my whole life forever. And the rich young ruler comes to Jesus and he says, Jesus, what do I have to do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus asks him, well, what does he think? And they have a discussion. And the end of the discussion, Jesus gives him the answer. Answers his question. Doesn't answer immediately, but he goes through and eventually gives him the answer. And the young man says to the King of Glory, thank you very much, but no thank you very much. Jesus allowed human beings the freedom of saying no. That's the frightening thing about salvation. People can actually reject Christ. And that freedom. And if in our classrooms, if in our teaching, if in our labs, we're not giving people the freedom to think a little bit differently, to act in slightly different kinds of ways. Now, I emphasize a little and slightly, because there are some things. When I'm supervising PhDs, I say, you know, most of the time I will give you my opinion. But sometimes I will say to you, you have to do this. And when I say you have to do this, I mean you will not get your PhD if you don't do it. A lot of the time it's just my opinion, my perspective. And you can debate and argue and disagree. But when I tell you, you have to do this, it's because I really believe we will not get the PhD unless you do. So I think there are some things which are non-negotiable. But there are many, many things where it's just our way. And we need to engage with people. Allow the freedom to reject and to refuse. But as I was preparing this, you may not believe I'm prepared, but I was preparing this and I was thinking, what was so special about Jesus? Here's Jesus who is walking through a town and he looks up in a tree and here's a man. And he says to this man, Zacchaeus, come down. I'm coming to your house for tea. You know, the children sing about, you know, going to Zacchaeus' house for tea. And as a result of Jesus going to that man's house, there was a total transformation. He gave back four times what he'd taken from other people through his tax gathering. His life, his whole relationship was fundamentally changed. And I think true teaching, true learning, is about transformation. It's about transformation now and future. I think of this woman at the well of Samaria, and she has a conversation with Jesus, and then she goes back to the town of Samaria, and she says, come on everybody, come and see a man who told me all I ever did. Would you really want to take, to meet somebody who was going to tell you all the things you ever said, all the things you ever did, all the things that you acted out? And that's the transformation that happened to that woman and in the town of Samaria. We don't have a TV guide. We have a thing called the Radio Times. It's not just for radio, it's for television as well. And as a true Scotsman, I do not buy the Radio Times. I hope somebody will leave one somewhere and I can pick it up and take advantage. But I confess, there was one occasion I did buy the Radio Times. And I bought it because I knew my name was going to be in it. So I turned up the program, there it was, mailbag, presenter Annie Nightingale, guest, Dr. David Cook. Brackets, professional Christian, close brackets. I thought, a professional Christian. And then I thought, well, that's better than being an amateur Christian. I wasn't very sure. I spent a lot of time working with business people, with lawyers, with social workers, doctors, nurses, thinking about what does it mean to be a professor? What does it mean to be in a profession? What does it mean to put forward some things? And I think it means that we're called. There's a sense in which God has called you to do what he's called you to do. He's called you to be the kind of person that you are, called you to be in a particular setting. There's a calling from God. And I think often we've lost that sense of vocation. God has given me certain gifts to be used in this setting for his purpose. That means you've been selected. One of my sons went to Oxford and he read English. And there were, I think, eight of them in the batch. And there were three professors, three lecturers in English. And they said to the student, the very first day, why are you here? He said, well, we're here to study English. No. Why did we choose you? I said, well, don't know. Why did you choose us? We chose you because when we interviewed you, there was a little leap in our hearts. We felt, it was interesting. Here they were in a faculty. They felt that these particular eight young people were able to do something in English that the other candidates they interviewed couldn't do. There was a selection. And that means, sadly, we have to say no to some in order to say yes to others. You are where you are because they said no to some people in order to select you because of who and what you are. But we need to be trained. That was one of the exciting things about being with graduate students last evening. Here are people who are in the process of being trained. Not just being trained in the intellectual, academic, scientific pursuits they have, but being trained as Christians, being developed, growing as people. And we need to make a much more conscious effort to train that next generation, to prepare them for the world. My students have one consistent complaint, whether in Oxford or whether in Wheaton. Cook never tells us the answer. And that is true. I do not tell them the answer. And they think it's because I don't know the answer. Now I know the answer. And I not only know the answer, I know the right answer. I still don't tell them. And I say to them, that's because you don't pay me enough to tell the answer. But the real reason is because I do not want people who simply parrot answers. because in 25 years' time, these young people will be the leaders. They'll be the teachers, they'll be the professors, they'll be running the country, they'll be running the media, running business, they'll be leading. And they'll be confronted with absolutely new moral problems that I have not even thought about. And if they say, well, David Cook says, what good is that going to be? What they need to be able to do is to work out for themselves what is the right way to behave, what's the right way to respond, what are the dangers here, how can we actually think through for ourselves. So I believe we need to prepare people not just for today but for tomorrow. And that to me is quite frightening, because you know, I look at my children, I look at my grandchildren and think, what will their world be like? And you know, I think of my father-in-law, 103, he remembers the day the first car came into Hoyk. He was there. He remembers the day in 1913 when the soldiers rode to war. Here they were riding on horses to the First World War. When they came back in tanks. In 4 years, warfare had changed fundamentally. He remembers the first time he heard the radio. He remembers the first time he saw television. In one individual's life, the change. Now, if that's true for our generation, his generation, how much more for our children? You know, with the internet, with that whole world, we ain't seen nothing yet. There are going to be such fundamental changes. How do we prepare people not just to cope, but to be in charge, to lead, to give good models for people, to organize? That's the challenge. And part of that, I think, is critical feedback about ourselves and about others. And of course, that's why now we have a transition for the last 20 minutes. The sign of being a good speaker is you speak for so long, there's no time left for discussion. But sadly, I failed. We have 20 minutes before we have a break. And this is not meant to be a question and answer, though I'm happy to take questions, and they are paying me enough for me to answer them. Rather a chance to share our perspective on some of the things that I've talked about, and particularly what interests me is the things that I should have talked about. You came along, you've given up a Saturday, you had certain expectations. What didn't I talk about that I should have talked about? It seems to me that that's as important, and I want to hear you as well as you hear me. The silence indicates your opportunity. Thank you.
A certain theme that kind of runs throughout a lot of what you've said today is how to cultivate or sculpt somebody's motivation for learning, but it was never discussed explicitly. How do you bring that out in somebody who's going to be a student? Not just how they're doing the learning, not just getting them to that point where they have that measure of creativity that they've explored, but also that they're doing it for the right reasons.
Well, I think about medical school interviews. We interview all the candidates. Now, we interview all the candidates because we are not confident that the recommendations, the references, are adequate. I say to many of the students I see, it's so nice to meet the Archangel Gabriel. because I've never met an Archangel before, but according to this reference, you are an Archangel. So you tell me, my first question, you tell me what's wrong with you. Because I know that there must be some weaknesses. And I want a student who is able to understand that he or she has certain weaknesses. They have a humility. Now, I don't want them to say, oh, I'm awful and there's nothing I can do. I don't want them to talk themselves out. I want them to be able to reflect and say, and I'm working on this, and this is how I'm working on it, and this is what I'm doing. So I think it's in the selection process. That's where motivation becomes fundamental. If we're going to take people in, we have, I think it's 112 students for every place in medical school. So one in 112 we're having to select. Now, we don't interview 112. You know, we weed out, and then we interview probably six for one place. And so we're looking to say, all right then, what kind of doctor will this person be? What is their motivation? What's driving them? And is that going to sustain them through in the medical education, 6 years in the UK, the 6 years of education, then the 2 years of professional qualification, and then they'll be able to be a doctor. Now, is this person really motivated? And once you have that motivation, once you know the person, it's the same with PhDs. I have lots of people who say, I want to do a PhD with you. And I say, why? Motivation is everything in taking them in. And once they're in, then they are motivated. Now what I have to do is to encourage, to help that motivation flourish, to help them cope with the hard times when it becomes depressed and it's hard going and the work is not going well. That's a different kind of thing. But I think the motivation has to be there. And you have to spot that in the selection. That would be my response. But others might disagree.
No, I'm not going to disagree, but I just wanted to... I've had at least two kinds of students with respect to this problem. Right. One is the student for which a connection does need to be made between the thing I'm learning and something I want to do.
Right.
Sometimes they're not aware of what those connections are, and they're, you know, surprised to find they exist.
But right.
That may be... But there, I've also, in the last few years, become aware, and I don't know if this is just, you know, changing culture, whatever it is, there's a certain kind of student whose question about motivation or whose apparent problem with motivation is really the need to be given the license to learn something that they're interested in for its own sake, and in a sense, and of course you can't carry this too far, mm-hmm. but in a sense not worry about what it's for,
right.
but simply enjoy and be given the freedom of a sort of an authority figure saying it's okay for you to right. like mathematics or philosophy or art history and study that and enjoy it for now, and let's not worry so
right.
much about it.
That's very helpful, because I think, I'm sorry if I gave the impression the motivation was all about what's going to happen in the future. Motivation can be because they saw an example. It's interesting with medical students. Many of the medical students I interview, they once met a doctor. They had experience of a doctor. It's the same with pastors, people who come into seminary. They had a pastor. They knew a pastor. And they want to be like him. They had a certain kind of experience. And that's their motivation. They are committed to being like that person. They thought this was a good doctor. This was a good pastor. And so the motivation can be all kinds of things. But I think there is certainly from parents, the motivation they're driving their kids is, what are you going to do with it? You know, it's all about the job, it's all about the future, it's all about making a reasonable living. And that rubs off on the young people. They are affected by that. So it's hard to have that second kind of category where, you know, I want to do this because this is interesting, this is exciting. And I say, this is the time in your life to do this. You know, if you don't do this now in your undergraduate studies, you're not going to have time when you're 40 to do it, because then you'll have so many demands and pressures, it's hard to take time out. So you make the most, you choose some different kind of course. You know, follow your heart in that sense. Not totally, not absolutely, not doing anything and everything, but something. Because it's important that learning is positive in and of itself.
Several of the examples you talked about, including Jesus' individual encounters, are great if you're in certain kind of context. You know, when I started off in one of my majors in college was music, and in studio sessions, you know, you have direct one-on-one contact. Probably there were some tears in some of those situations with some of the music tutorials, very similar to the tutorial system. But I'm a science professor now, and at a major public university, most of my communication sessions involve Sermon on the Mount or Sermon on the Plain discourse.
Right, right.
And I really don't have opportunities very often for one-on-one encounters. And so right. I'm wondering, Jesus used that methodology sometimes.
Yes, he did.
And how do you think about, given the constraints of that method, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I want to make two responses, if I may. First of all, one of the interesting things in the, you know, 1,000 or 5,000 kind of lecture settings is that the really keen student will make an opportunity to talk to you one-on-one. And so it's interesting to see that level of motivation, because it's not an easy thing for a young person to come out, you know, from 100 or 150 people and say, please, can you answer this question? So I think we do have some kind of opportunity, but it's much limited, you're quite correct. But Jesus, I believe, as I read the New Testament, as I believe, when he taught the crowds, and where the crowds reacted and said, he taught them not like the scribes and the Pharisees, but somebody who had authority. Now the word is exousia. It means there was something about him and the way he related, something about the examples he used, something about the way that he spoke that was winsome. I like that word, winsome. It was attractive. And I think that's what full of grace and truth is. It's actually speaking the truth, but it's actually attractive. you cannot not be drawn to it. Now, you might not agree with it, you might not like it, but there's something attractive. You can't leave it alone. You saw this with children, how children wanted to come to Jesus, and the parents wanted Jesus to touch the children, to be with the children. And they started saying, no, keep the kids away. And there was something winsome, attractive. And I think that's where, in the public lecture setting, there needs to be a certain kind of attraction. And so you have to use the personality that God's given us. You have to use the thinking about what is the audience like? What can they understand? One thing I've learned in broadcasting is what I want to say is irrelevant. What's important is what they can hear. And the audience. And I think that's why, if I've had any success in broadcasting, it's because the audience responds. And so, you know, with students, you know, we have a feedback session. Now, the feedback session is not to make everybody feel better, or in my case, to feel worse. It's to say, how can we improve on a day like this? What would actually change? And I think that kind of, you can tell, if you're lecturing to 100 people, you can see when you lose them. You know the moment you get the glazed eye, the head down, they're reading the book, they're on their phone, they're clicking, all that kind of stuff. You can see it. And so at that point, you'd say, hold on, and engage in a different kind of way. That's the challenge. It's being creative in the setting where we can find another way of communicating. Now, I have to confess that there comes a point where I've explained it one way, and they still don't understand. Explain it another way, and they still don't understand. And I have to say to them, look, it's just complicated. I haven't got any more ways of illustrating. It's just as it is. And so you're going to have to struggle with this until you can grasp it for yourself. I can do the best I can, but I'm limited as well. And so I think we have to recognize that it doesn't always work. Sometimes I use little clips from other people's lectures, because I think that he or she has actually expressed it far better than I can. And yeah, I could take it and pretend it was mine. But actually just, you know, a different face, a different voice, a different kind of perspective. And sometimes that breaks the logjam of, you know, getting them engaged, getting their focus of attention, getting them to think outside the box, getting them to understand in a different kind of way. But it's audience. So what does the audience hear? What does the audience understand? If you've got ears to hear, let them hear. Got eyes to see, let them see. Let's really communicate to them.
Okay, so since no one's jumping in, I'm going to monopolize you. So I guess one thing you also said, and you just hinted at this just now, is we have to teach to our audience. But right. I will confess there's a part of me that wants to exercise some parentalism and say that it's not always about what they want, but it is fundamentally, as with our own children, about what they need.
Right, absolutely.
So there's this balance of getting your foot in the door through what they want, but
right.
then trying to transition in right. some ways, not disingenuously, but right. but to what they really need in the classroom. I guess one of the issues that I maybe you can comment on, I know... you don't seem like PowerPoint is a central passion of your life.
This is true.
But
how perceptive this man is.
I know, yeah. Students nowadays seem to be information grazers. This
oh, yes.
is what they are.
Right.
They learn how to do this through YouTube and Wikipedia and,
right.
and what have you. And to what extent do you think we need to fight against that, given that that's where they start?
Right. I don't think we need to fight against it. I think your description, you begin where people's needs are, where people's wants are, and you move to people's needs. I think that's the Jesus method. You know, somebody comes and says, this is what I'm interested in, and Jesus begins there and then takes them somewhere else. And so I think it's that ability to lead people from the particular situation. People do need help. My students, I say to them, when you're given a topic that you know nothing about, you don't understand, then begin with the encyclopedias. Begin with going online. Begin with Google. Begin with Wikipedia. Don't believe it, but begin there. Begin there so that you have a way in. Now, what happens, I said, you know, somebody's written lots of dictionary articles. You're given 500 words. So if I've only got 500 words, I can only tell you the important things. So what I have to do at the end is to say, and here are three books, because this is a source. And so they can read my 500 words, they get some idea. What are the kinds of themes that they're... Because I would not have passed the editor. I wouldn't have passed the process. I wouldn't have made it into print unless I'd done that. And then there's some other pointing them in another direction. So I want to encourage them to read for themselves, to read widely. But I want them to do it in a critical, reflective kind of way. And then to build on that. So I think some PowerPoint presentations, I'm almost moved to tears. They're amazing. You know, I wish I could do it. I regard it as a weakness that I can't do it, because I think I would communicate better with this generation if I were able to use their particular tools. But even with a great deal of education and a lot of training and a lot of help, that's not going to happen now. So point them in that direction, though. That doesn't mean don't use it. And, you know, this last week, because of Susan Boyle and because of the Miss America pageant, you know, this gay question, you know, that's been a gift, because I've been in Kansas City, I've been in Wheaton, I've been here in Madison. I've talked about it in all these places because everybody knows about it. Everybody is into that particular immediate access internet culture. And so we begin where people are, and that can open all kinds of doors.
My teaching is somewhat different. I've taught as an adjunct for adult learners.
Right.
And thankfully in a Catholic university, so I get to teach the theology class.
Right.
Good. After teaching it a couple times, I realized that what I was putting into my preparation and lecture came from the books that I'd read, and I looked and I said, these people have never read any religious book, let alone
right.
theology book.
Right.
And so I incorporated that into my requirement that they, for the over the course, that they right. pick a book. I said, mm-hmm. anything. I gave them, you know, different presses that they could mm-hmm. choose from and so forth. And then they would have to report on it. And they all found it very interesting. And I had everything from, you know, I said they couldn't, it couldn't be a novel. They had to be, and so I had everything, you know, from 90 Minutes in Heaven to... Or, you know, to and somebody read some fairly deep theologian.
Mm-hmm.
So, right. And they found that very interesting. So that was kind of
Right, that's a way of building on and encouraging.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, book reports and that kind of thing do help people. You know, a lot of my colleagues use quizzes to make sure the students do the reading. I'm too old-fashioned. I say, you know, if you don't want to read, don't read. But I can assure you, you won't understand. So don't bother coming to class if you can't if you're not going to read. You know, if you've not done the work, then you're wasting your time, you're wasting my time, and you fail. You know, so I'm pretty brutal. But I don't think that's the best way to be. I think, you know, if I could engage the culture and build on it in that kind of way that you've done, that's very positive, very constructive. Yeah, we ought to do that. One more question. So who gets the last one from us? Here we go.
You've done some interaction with the public, so outside of academia, and a lot of what is more common in academia now is students who are in class so that they can get the grade, so that they can get the degree, so that they can get the job, and that is their goal. Their motivation
right.
is the end job, and there's nothing in between.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see a connection between how you had to interact with the non-academic public over the radio, and how professors or instructors of any kind may have to interact with either like high school or undergraduate students, and in either case, whether you do see a connection there or not, what do you do when you are interacting with the public or with that kind of demographic that makes the teaching still meaningful?
I think that there is some kind of connection. My general view, particularly in teaching philosophy, is assume total ignorance, and then I can't go wrong. Where I go wrong is when I assume that these people have read, they've understood, they have a framework, and I discover that you cannot assume that. So I assume total ignorance. So in that way, the public and most students are much the same, total ignorance. But they are people who have concerns in their life. And they have, if you address the particular concerns, so when I'm in public context, whether it's a public meeting, public debate or radio or television, then you're thinking, what is happening in the lives of these people? And so people are all talking about Susan Boyle. It's the water cooler kind of mentality. People are talking about that. And people know what American Idol. I mean, even I know that David Cook won the American Idol competition last year. Now, the reason I know that is because somebody said, go to this site. So I went to this site, and here was MP3 downloads. And here is David Cook, resource allocation. Here is David Cook, bioethics today. And here is David Cook singing five different songs. It was all in this one site. And so you have to begin where people are, and then show them that in ethics, what I try to do is I show them that issues are very complicated, that actually it's not very straightforward. So you need to think about this, and how are we going to think about it? And that's when they say, give me some help. So that you get to the next stage. Now, that only doesn't only work in ethics, but it does work in ethics. So you have to find whatever the area is, what are the particular needs, and how can I respond to them in a way which will open up rather than close down. And I think teaching is not about giving people the answer and finishing the conversation. It's about helping them to think and reflect and ask more kinds of questions so they become a thinking, reflective, critical, creative kind of person. But Terry's standing there with books in his hands, so thank you all for your patience.